beautiful introduction. Welcome to the Guitar Channel. I am super happy to welcome you a new interview. I have on the other side of the Zoom connection the one and only Andy Wood. Andy, how are you doing today?
I'm fabulous. Thanks for having me, Pierre.
It's a pleasure. I mean, it's lovely to have someone with a gorgeous guitar sound and a great voice sound because we have the same microphone. So what's best than that, right?
I know. If it's good enough for Howard Stern, it's good enough for me, you know?
That's correct. All right, tell me, before we start, I have to officially thank Mark Lettieri, who introduced you to me. So thank you very much, Mark, if you are watching this, because it's a great pleasure to be able to have Andy on the show. So Andy, tell me a little bit more about your story. What was your very first guitar?
My first guitar, my family played music. So there was always instruments around the house. My grandfather played and, he had three daughters and no sons. So okay. One daughter finally had a son and another daughter had a son. So he finally had two grand boys in the family, right? So two grandkids that were both boys. Immediately when we turned about 6 years old, he gives one of us the fiddle and another one a mandolin. He grew up, you know, he played a lot of bluegrass and fiddle tunes and Appalachian music and things like that. So at that point, we just started playing fiddle tunes and Bill Monroe bluegrass standards and Flat and Scruggs and all that kind of stuff and classic country. And then I played mandolin most of my life up until I was probably 16 or 17 years old. And then I heard Brent Mason's solo on Pick It Apart. And that was a Mark O'Connor album that I'd bought, ironically, because of the banjo and mandolin okay. playing on the album, right? But it was Brent Mason's solo on that, and it just changed my life. It led me to the electric guitar. It was very much like in the Family Guy episode where Stewie hears the banjo for the first time. And he's, what is that glorious sound? You know, nice. Like, so it definitely hit me like that. Yeah. So as I was saying, I heard the electric guitar solo on Pick It Apart. And then from there, I discovered Eddie Van Halen because when I started playing electric guitar, you know, I got into electric guitar so much later in life, right? Music had been a part of my life for 15 years up until this point, you know? So I knew that Eddie Van Halen was important. I was like, well, I'm going to buy his music because, you know, so I found the live right here, right now recording. Mm-hmm. And then I immediately went and bought everything else that he ever did. it's like, this is incredible. So between that and a mixtape, like a mix CD that a guy that I worked with at a theater, he made for me. And it had all of the industry standard electric guitar show-off tunes. It had Too Many Notes from Steve Morse, Cliffs of Dover by Eric Johnson, yeah. For the Love of God. It had everything that I should have heard up at that point in my life, and I had never heard. So immediately, it was just like discovering that the world wasn't flat, you know what I mean, all at the same time.
It's not flat.
And so, so at that point, I just felt like I was overwhelmed with so much great music and just started listening to all of it, you know, from the heaviest of metal to fusion to, you know, country stuff to classic, you know, 50s and 60s jazz. I mean, and then I went to school at the University of Tennessee okay. for a couple of years for jazz. They have a great jazz program over there. I started getting hired for gigs and sessions, so I never graduated. I just dropped out and went to work. But that's, you know, from there we were off to the races and you know, hadn't stopped playing guitar since.
And do you remember the very first guitar riff or guitar song you were able to play on the guitar? And you know, the guitar riff that you can't stop to play because you are so happy to be able to play. What was it? And can you play it?
Yeah, let me think here. You know, most of the stuff, the first thing that I was happy to play would be just to be able to play a bluegrass rhythm from, you know. And when I could finally play that G run like Del McCurry, I was like, man, I've made it. I'm the coolest guy in the room, you know, like now I've done it. And then from there, you know, it's like the intro to Cliffs of Dover. If I could just play that, or if I could just play the Too Many Notes, if I could just do that, I'll be the coolest guy in the room, you know? So it just keeps, never stops. But yeah, I mean, the first stuff I learned was definitely more bluegrass oriented things like,
thank you.
You know, that was the kind of music that was going around my house.
And how do you go from this to Van Halen? It must be such a wide spectrum, suddenly out of the blue, in front of, in your ears, in your head.
I mean, yeah, it's the beauty of the instrument, though, really, right? Mm. Like, that's the beauty of the guitar, is just how far it can be manipulated into different directions. I remember the first thing that really kind of wrecked my mind, and it was just like, how does this happen? I had bought, I was really obsessed with Eric Johnson. Like, that was, for many years, as we all are, it's like, Eric, you know? So I'd got the G3 DVD with Satch and Vi. And I just put it in. I was like, I'd never heard Joe Satriani up to that point. I was just like, okay, who's this guy? Okay, awesome.
Who is this Italian guitar player I never heard of? Yeah.
yeah. And so, like, he's playing the chrome ride and doing the whammy bar tricks. And I was just like, what? How does this happen? And then Steve Vai comes out, fan blowing, epic. And I was like, all right, this guy means business. And he, like, licks his finger on his right hand, taps something, and keeps his right hand in the air and just legatos everywhere. And I was just like, well, that's impossible. How, you're not picking the strings. This can't be done. Keep in mind, the gear that I had in my collection was one blue Telecaster, a PV Bandit.
Okay.
A Dynacomp and a yellow overdrive pedal from Boss, and that was it.
Steve Vai rig. Yeah.
I was like, this can't be done. There's somebody's edited it, you know. And then I got into the, went to a music store and was like, how does this, what's happening? They were like, oh yeah, you need way more gain, and you need this, and this is, you're never gonna be able to do it with clean tone, you know. And so it just wrecked me. I was just like, this is impossible. How do you get tone without striking the string in your right hand? You know, as a mandolin player, you really only get one pull off on the mandolin, or even on acoustic guitar. You don't get loads of pull offs and hammer-ons. Mm. Like, they disappear. You have to keep striking the string. So that really, like, leveled me beyond anything else, beyond the harmony and the songs and everything. I was just like, well, physically this can't be done, you know. Of course it can. It's Steve Vai.
And how do you think playing the mandolin influenced your guitar playing?
I would say a lot of my lines in my improvisation are coming, I hear them in my head more like a mandolin and fiddle player would. Like, a lot of my lines are very linear.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? I enjoy angular playing. But when I hear a melody in my head, it tends to have more of that linear kind of sound. It's just, you know, the nature of the music that I grew up on. And that's heavily influenced. And also with alternate picking, I get a lot of questions and a lot of emails and a lot of things about my picking technique. And it's from, you know, working on bluegrass things and playing mandolin for so many years. And, the cross-picking thing, I get questions about that, you know. Those kind of things, right?
Mm-hmm. Can you give us an example of a melody, or I don't know, a riff that a typical guitar player would play, and how you are approaching it because you have this mandolin history?
Yeah, like, let me think for a second. I think, a lot of guitar players like to do, like, that kind of thing. And when I hear those kind of lines, it ends up being, like, it ends up having these little passing tones that flesh out the scale a little bit more, you know? Like, instead of just playing, I would play, definitely adding notes to the scale, of course, but in the phrase, there's more of that. Almost Celtic stuff. I really love these little pull-offs. And that's very fiddle-esque, you know.
Okay, interesting. You already named a couple of famous guitar players. Who are other very important influences in your guitar playing, in your music?
Yeah. Tony Rice, for obviously... You know, to me, he's the greatest bluegrass acoustic guitar player that's ever lived. And rest in peace. You know, recently we lost him. Brent Mason, because he brought me to the electric guitar in his playing. and Eddie Van Halen, because he was my gateway drug into all everything else. You know, that was a gateway drug into distortion. Eric Johnson, Steve Morse, Jeff Beck, I would say Jimmy Olander from Diamond Rio, B-Bender kind of player. Dan Huff, Mike Landau. So I, you know, I like really melodic guys. Steve Lukather, I love big melody. You know, it's the thing that stays with me. You know as well as I do, in today's world, there's no shortage of chops. Get on Instagram for 5 minutes and there's chops everywhere. The thing that I tend to look for these days are guys like Andy Timmons. I mean, he's been such a massive influence for me over the past few years because we've worked together a lot more recently and done shows and camps and things. And I've always made the joke that Andy Timmons has been Obi-Wan Kenobi to me. He's just taught me about the power of a melody. You know what I mean? When I think of Obi-Wan in Star Wars, he could do so much with just such a little movement, you know? And so, and that's the way I think of Andy. He can just take a melody that any chops obsessed Instagram guitarist would kind of scoff at, and Andy can just bring you to tears. You know what I mean? There was a moment where he was just kind of warming up playing Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, Elton John, and he was just kind of getting his tone right. It was the most beautiful thing I'd ever heard. You know, so that kind of level of command over really delivering the tone of the instrument, that that's the thing that's really gotten so good to me. And I think even in Ed's playing, as pyrotechnic as Eddie Van Halen was, there's that sense of groove and melody, and his song, his solos and his riffs, they're like songs within songs within songs. You know what I mean? And I think all of the great players that we all love, they have that. That's the thing that it's not, you know, that's the secret sauce or whatever you want to call it. But yeah, my influences are all over the place. If you ask me about jazz influences, it's got to be George Benson. He's sassy. I love really sassy players. I'm a huge fan of slide guitar players, even though I'm not necessarily a slide guitar player. I've worked hard to develop a faux slide, fake slide technique.
Give us so an guys example like, of a faux slide.
So guys like Dwayne Allman, you know, and Derek Trucks and Sonny Landreth. Let me see if I can get you something here. I'm going to turn this delay off and see if we got something. Yeah. So like taking this kind of... Yeah, that kind of thing. You know, those kind of those kind of things, definitely lifted from Ian Thornley and Derek Trucks and Sonny Landreth and Lowell George from Little Feat. You know, all my players are all over the board. I just like good picking.
And talking about melody and how to include that in your guitar playing, did you consciously work on that to add this to your guitar playing? Because we tend to be obsessed at the beginning at I want to be the fastest guy on earth and blah, blah, blah. And then after that, we realize that speed is good, but melody is much better. So... did you consciously work on that, or how did you incorporate that in your playing, or was it right from the start?
That's a tough question because, you know, so much of the music I was playing, early on, I was playing tunes with my family that was like... So I was playing Tennessee Waltz and these big melodic things a lot. But then we would also be playing very high horsepower bluegrass fiddle tunes. And then I would, like I said, I got into the chicken picking. So it's almost like there is that element of like, yeah, you have to have a lot of technique to do the chicken picking thing. But even within it, there's more to it than just the technique itself. So I think it was always there. However, to answer the question very directly, on my first record, I was, you know, 25 or 26, and I didn't have a big budget, and I had to record and write and make everything in like 10 days. Like, that's all the studio time I could buy, you know? And so it sounds very much like a guy in his, you know, 20s playing, you know, in odd time signatures with, you know, diminished scalar stuff and trying to show off to my peers that I can do all the things. However, my newest record, you know, four records later and a lot of growing up, I feel like I've found my sound a lot more and blending in melody and the Southern roots with, you know, some flashier moments. But I feel like the songs are so much better mm-hmm. now because I've put that focus on it and tried to glue things together a little bit more, you know, and look internally for my sound instead of looking externally.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about, so Junktown was released in 2019, right?
Yeah.
So can you walk us through what is usually your composition process? I don't know, maybe if you can start with the title track and explain what was the initial idea? Was it a chord progression, a melody, and how do you work on that to after that come up with what we basically have on the record?
Yeah, when I was doing Junktown, it kind of started as we were touring and playing and doing shows and stuff, and every sound check, you know, a front of house engineer is always like, hey, can I hear some guitar, give me the guitar, you know, and I would just play for all the younger guitar players, when a front of house guy asks for guitar, yeah. Do not shred. Okay. They don't want to hear you shred. They don't want to hear all the licks you've been working on. They want to hear a riff that is the meat and potatoes of what you're going to play throughout the evening so they can dial in the sound.
Good advice.
So I always had this like just default riff for like, you know, almost a whole year just laying around. Finally, someone was like, man, are you ever going to write that song? It's like, dude,
what song?
I guess I should. Yeah, I guess I should. And so it developed and it kind of grew into. You know, it kind of grew into like its own thing. And from there, you know, when I sit down to make a record, I don't really sit down to make a record. I just like at night when I'm feeling something, I'll like jot it down in my phone or on my iPad if I'm on the road, or I'll come down to the studio and just jot down the rough idea. And one of the things that was hard for me, but most rewarding, was getting to the point where I wasn't trying to finish the song and mix it and everything. Like, I used to be like, oh, I need to tune up and get the perfect tone. And by that point, the inspiration's gone. Now I won't let myself. I'll pick the guitar up and it's in tune with itself close enough. And then I make myself get to the idea of the thing on my mind versus obsessing over all the things surrounding that idea, the tone and this and that. It's like, man, just jot down. And if the riff is strong, it will cut through not having like having a demo tone or the guitar being out of tune or anything. And from that point, I just had like 40 or 50 different demos like that. And so I just went with my buddy Ben Eller and we started culling out all the things that weren't strong. And it's funny because when you hear something raw and out of tune and kind of late at night and not very good, you can tell what's great and what's not, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Because you're hearing it in its purest form. So that's kind of been the way that I've been writing a lot more. And I've done that for my next record that I'm working on now. And at this point though, I have to say my buddy Misha, he's in Periphery. He sent me over some of his drum packs and I'm pretty anti-software stuff as far as like making records because And the reason is because I track at my house. I'm a session player, so I don't need a bunch of mixing tools and plugins and all that stuff. I need great raw guitar tones. And he's like, man, you're going to love these. Check these out. So he sent them over. Now I'm having a blast with them. So it's like helping me with like the demos. I'm like, oh, man, cool. And I think the thing that's so cool about what he does with those, and it's been inspirational for me lately, is the fact that he's just getting real drummers. You know what I mean? And just recording their samples. So when you load up a loop, it's the hi-hats are at different velocities, the kick drum, you know what I mean? It feels real. It feels a lot more real, a lot less drum machine. So that's been very inspirational, but still yet to this day, I'm just like, get me a raw riff and I can, and if it's good, it's good. And if it's not, it will, it won't make the cut, you know, and I like to start making a record with about 40 or 50 demos.
Okay, so most of the time it is a guitar riff on top of which you build a song.
A lot of times, now I write a lot on mandolin too.
Okay.
My
and
song.
And then you translate it to guitar.
Yeah. There's a riff on my record that's the main theme to Forgotten Secrets. That was written on mandolin.
Okay.
And so I brought it over, and after that's where I needed we need to come in with a big gutty riff. And that's actually inspired by some of the stuff that you might hear from Tool. I like heavy music.
Okay.
And they would have riffs like those kind of chuggy riffs. Obviously I'm not in drop D, but those kind of pull off kind of things. So blending, a tune that starts out on mandolin on my couch and with influences from prog metal. That's kind of I live in the middle,
And how do you know, when do you know that the song is finished and ready to be recorded? Do you need someone to tell you, okay, Andy, that's enough, we need to record this, or how do you do it?
I made peace with the idea that songs are never finished, and it was the most liberating thing ever. And by that I mean, look at Panama from Van Halen. Every time he played it, there was something different. He just implied something else different. So yeah, the song was finished, but it's never really finished. And with my favorite music, if you hear Jeff Beck play Nessun Dorma, he does little different quirky things every time. There's always something. It seems like it's always evolving, and that each performance can be slightly different. As far as when it's ready to go to the album, I think it's ready to go to the album when I put a guitar solo on it.
Okay.
By that, I mean, if you have an album full of instrumental guitar, where does the guitar solo start? By that, a song like Junktown or maybe Third and Lonely or some of those songs off my record, the melodies are verses and choruses. And it's it's put together I want you as the listener, even if you don't play guitar, to know where the guitar solo starts in a song that's a guitar solo. I think that was always super impactful to me. Look at Cliffs of Dover. When the guitar solo starts because it cries like... When he starts into that, you're like, okay, now he's gone somewhere else and it's different. We're getting something new. And when a song reaches that, to me... And it reaches that point where there's the bed of improvised changes, chord changes that I'm playing over, and I start having fun with it. That's when I know the song's done, because that's the last. I never let myself put guitar solos on demos.
Okay.
When I do my demos, I never do all right, now we're going to shred in this section. I always be is the song strong enough without a guitar solo? Could it be played on a piano? Could it be played on a mandolin or a fiddle and someone recognize the tune? And if the answer is yes, then it's ready to go,
And then after that, so how do you work on the solo? Do you have some ideas about what you're going to play?
Improvise it in the studio.
Yeah, improvisation. Yeah.
All the solos on Junktown were improvised.
Okay.
And sometimes they twist. And what I like to do is Ben and I, there was nobody else involved on that record. It was just me and Ben. We sent the parts out if we wanted a banjo part or whatever, but as far as putting the album together, it was us. And I would just take three or four solos, five or six solos, and just have fun. That's when the best solos came out. And then we would just pick the one we like and be like, maybe do the front half of we'll take the front half of that one, let's take the back half of that one, and I need a lick right in the middle to marry those two together. And then that's the only thing I would compositionally be like, oh yeah, I need to get from this point, this theme, this over here.
And then would replay the pieces together?
Not if it had the vibe. Yeah. If it had the vibe and the magic was in that, I would rather have that and use a little lick that I could drop in than replay something. A lot of times my playing will be more sterile if I'm recreating. And the more times I recreate it, it's like tape degradation. My playing gets lamer the more I try to do the same thing over and over again. Because when I'm playing off the cuff and off the seat of my pants, I don't know where I'm going. So there's an excitement there that I want to capture. And it's really important for listeners, because if they come see me live, I'm going to improvise. Like, we're going to take those solos and they're going to stretch. And I might have a steel guitar player with me. I might have another guitar player. I might have banjo or keyboards or whatever. We're going to stretch those sections. I don't do the kind of music where you've heard it on the album and now you're going to hear it recreated note for note live, and it's going to be nothing but the same thing. Like, that's not what I do. And so when I'm trying to capture that energy in the studio, I really want to capture that. I want to improvise. Sometimes it's great. Sometimes you have to do it again.
Yeah. As we can see on the picture, you have a lot of gear around you. So let's talk about what you used on the record.
Yeah. I used, on the record, I used a lot of these Sur amps behind me.
Yeah.
And the primary overdrive was the prototype. Here it is.
The Wampler gearbox.
So this one was like, I wasn't happy with the final outcome. This is before we got it perfect, but this is a large part. I would say this is 85% of the record.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when we got Gearbox out, a lot of people were like, "Oh man, you really nailed the album tone from Junktown." I'm like, "Yeah, of course it is." Like, what it was. But yeah, you know, these Sur Bella heads I really like, and then I use Hedgehog a lot. For a song like Catapult, I use that Synergy, the Synergy rack unit on the SLO module. And then I used some, for the really crystal clean stuff, I like the Diesel on the clean channel, believe it or not. I know that's a shred amp, but it's got a beautiful clean channel that doesn't add a lot of character, which is nice, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I mix it up. I try to get the right guitar for the job and the right amp for the job and try to EQ as little as possible. Mm-hmm. Like, I want the raw fundamental tone to be as strong as it can be.
And when you use the gearbox for your tone, the Bella Sur amplifier is dialed clean then? All the gain is coming from the pedal?
Yeah, the Bella is kind of very much like a blackface bassman. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you want that thing loud and punchy, but no grit. There's no grit on it. It's not like a Marshall or anything. I will say the coolest piece of gear that we got to use on that record was courtesy of my friend Todd. Todd has several of Eric Johnson's guitars, and he has one of Eric Johnson's 100-watt amps that I think was used on Venus Isle. And I did a tribute to Eric called Back to Austin. And on that, Todd brought down his Marshall, and I played one of Eric's Strats and Eric's Marshall for that song. So that was very sentimental and inspirational, and it was, you know, I've steered clear of doing that for a long time because in my early 20s, I didn't have an identity. I just wanted to be Eric. Mm-hmm. So I took a long time before I was ready to do any kind of like tribute tune to him. But it was cool to play on his amp and know that I'd heard that amp on another recording of his at some point in time.
What about the guitars? Tell us about your connection with Johnson. We talked a little bit about the amplifier. You have a signature model with Sur guitars. So tell us everything.
Yeah, I started working with John, 11 years ago. I was pup. I was a wee pup. And it was back in MySpace days, like towards the end of MySpace days.
I remember those days. Yeah, I'm that old. Yes.
The guy that was running the A&R side had found me on a tribute kind of thing. There was a forum page that a lot of us were on, a lot of us as in the forum was johnpetrucciforum.com, and it was Tom Quell was on there, Martin Miller, myself, Rick Graham, Andy James, and we were always sending videos to each other, and that's how we became good buddies.
Okay.
And so I was discovered through that from the guy that was running it, and I went to I bought my first couple of Surs. They gave me a little discount, you know, the rookie discount or whatever you want to call that. But it still was a lot of money. And over the course of the years, my career grew. And then my needs and wants changed. And at a certain point, my career gotten really good. And I was playing with some very high profile artists. And, you know, I had a couple of records out of my own. And like notoriety was starting to kind of cut through. And I told the guys, sir, I really wanted to improve the Telecaster. And they're all rolling their eyes, you know.
Yeah,
that doesn't need to be improved. Yeah, you don't need to improve. It's fine, you know. So John makes very great versions of old Fenders. Mm-hmm. Like anybody, you can get the nitro cellulose. You can really dial it in to be like those old 60s, 50, you know, 50s and 60s guitars. So I said, I've always been a Tele player, but I've always hated the heel joint because it hits the back of the hand. And I, at that time, I was playing a lot of John's Moderns, which is the, you know, to me, that has the best heel joint that I've ever played. And I said, can we put that on one of the Teles? He's like, oh, man, no, no, no. So I wore him out about it for 8 or 9 months. And finally, he's like, I'll build one for you if you'll just shut up. He's like, we're not going to sell it. It's not a thing. This is for you.
Keep
and
it
that guitar
secret.
Is in my
Don't
lap.
Don't show it to anyone.
Yeah. Well, it wasn't even that. He was just like, just be quiet. Just stop emailing me. And here it is. This is the world's first 24-fret Sir Tele style guitar. And there was the heel joint. So this one was made, kind of fabricated. And then when they wanted to do a signature model for me, based it on this. And then we stepped into nailing that traditional tone. So John had some various pickups, and I worked with him to pick out one that did what I wanted. And ironically, it was from a schematic of a guitar that he fixed when he was up in Rudy's in mm-hmm.
New York.
And the guitar was a gift to Les Paul from Leo Fender. And something had happened, and John had to like take the guitar apart electronically. I don't know the exact story. He made a note of the bridge pickup because he thought it sounded so good. And that schematic laid around for, you know, his notes laid around for years. And finally, he was like, he whipped it up. And as soon as he put it in a guitar, I plugged it into the Bella before the Bella was finished. It was just a chassis. He said, what do you think about this? I was like, that's it. That is the thing. And then he told me the story, which was extra cool because I didn't have any nepotism to the pickup, you know, selection. And so that was really great. John is like family, and now Kevin is like family. I remember when Kevin was like 18, you know, and now he's grown up. And Kevin and I are the ones that did the woodshed compressor.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah. So that was all Kevin, and man, he hit a home run. They approached me about doing a compressor pedal. And I've, of course, being a country background, like I have every compressor known to man. Like I have three of my favorite ones and then all these other ones, you know, and I've tried all of them. And so we wanted to make notes of like what we like, what I liked, what I didn't like. And yeah, man. So the Woodshed comp came out. It's a home run. And one of the most flattering things, I knew we really got it right, was when Rick Beato called me on the phone. And he's like, Andy, this is the best compressor pedal I've ever played. It's on my board. And it wasn't 3 days later. He took a picture of his board and there it was. I was like, all right, Rick, thanks, dude. So yeah, really proud of that. And when I talk about Sir, I don't even feel like I'm talking about a company that I work with. I mean, that's my friends and family. You know, I mean, it's you work with a company so long, it transcends business at a certain point. I'm sure I still annoy the hell out of them. Like, hey, have you thought about maybe we could do, and maybe we can make it do, you know, and they're like, oh, God, please.
Can you do a short demo or demo of the woodshed of the compressor? Let us hear.
Yeah, sure can. No. Let me turn this off. I'll turn the delay off, too. So we got... There's just my core signal with some reverb. So this guitar, I'll just play on the neck pickup. Now I'm going to step on the compressor. So it adds a little bit of that spark to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I usually run it where there's quite a bit of boost level. So one more time, here's without it. Step on it. So it bumps it up quite a bit. There's this split setting on the guitar, which is just the neckmost coil.
Okay.
And I'm going to play some without the compressor. With it. It's really great for the country thing, you know. Here's without it. With it. Mm-hmm. And to be noted, this is not, for those that can't see the podcast and are only listening, this is my humbucker version of the guitar. So obviously the single coil sounds a little bit more traditional, but you can kind of tell. One of the things I like to do is take the gearbox and run it on a kind of a channel 2 only. So mm-hmm. Here's just the gearbox. Here's just gearbox coming at you. Now I'm going to add in the compressor. It adds a lot more of that chirp to the notes.
And
you
the
know?
Compressor is
in front.
Before in front. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So again, here's without it on like a neck pickup thing. With it. You can really get the guitar to sing without adding more hair to mm-hmm. the tone, which is really important to me.
Excellent. Sounds really great, even through the Zoom sound. So I can't wait to hear the sound you are recording on your end. Excellent. What was the impact of the pandemic on your life as a musician when life stopped about 1 year ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think anybody that keeps up with me notices or noticed that I was instantly creating tons of content. Like I immediately started doing all kinds of things because I was home.
Yeah.
You know, for the better part of 10 years, I've been on the road, various touring gigs with multiple different artists and things like that. So now I was home. I was like, well, I'm gonna make videos and do some live streaming and do more things like this and like work on things like gearbox and woodshed compressor. So I definitely worked my ass off. I was like, there was no shortage of things to do. However, I became very, very aware of how much I needed that live music scenario. Okay. Like mm-hmm. I really thrived on that. And my mental health is tied to playing music for people in a room. And I just was unaware of how important it was to me. And I can safely say, like, Saturday night, I got to play the Grand Ole Opry again with a country artist. And when I walked on that stage, man, I had every feeling, like adrenaline, happiness, like emotion. It was just like, this is where I belong. Like I belong playing for, you know, in the moment. And I don't like to say that I took it for granted, because I didn't really know that I took it for granted until it was taken away. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh man, I need, like, I value playing live. So I can't wait to do more live shows. I did my first show with my solo stuff in Mississippi a couple of weeks back. And, man, it felt good to do that. And then, of course, doing the John Petrucci guitar event in Irvine. So shout out to John Petrucci Guitar Universe. We're going to be doing that at the end of July. And then I'm having my woodshed camp in August. So I'm so stoked to do that again. So it was just a wake-up call. And now it's like I really value that live thing a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A little bit earlier, you mentioned that you were already working on your next album. So when can we expect that? And what can we expect on that?
Yeah, I say you guys can expect it when it's done.
Okay, thank you very much.
Yeah, man, you know, I don't like to put too much of a time constraint because I want the album to feel good, you know, and I think that's something, you start putting too much time limitations on it as things start not feeling good and you start looking for completion instead of perfection. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that there's no such thing as perfect, but I want things to feel good when they go out. I would say I'll be recording it and getting drums and laying it down this year, this summer. I've actually started, you know, culling through the demos. So soon, you know, I'd say in the next 11-12 months, we'll have that thing out. As far as what you can expect, hopefully good songs, hopefully okay. good melodies. You know, that's the thing that I'm trying to do more than anything. You might get a cover. I've been toying with the idea of taking some of my favorite tunes. I did this once, and I did it on Truth and Lie, where I took Fool in the Rain by Zeppelin, and I kind of made it a and nice. I did all the parts at the same time, you know, and I did it on acoustic. And I thought, man, it might be cool. Over the course of the pandemic, I was doing, you know, instrumental covers of things like Alice in Chains and Foo Fighters and stuff that music that's not guitar nerd music, but it's just good music. Mm-hmm. And Ben and I talked about for the Andy Wood Trio that we tour, like incorporating more of that. One of my, you know, my nothing wrong with hearing songs that you love. I mean, Tommy Emmanuel does that so well, and you know, a lot of great players do that so well. So I was like, man, I love so much music that's not in this lane. And Ben's like, dude, play it live. So we're talking about some of that. They might get one of those on the album to kind of allude to what you might get at a live show. So we'll see. Mm-hmm. Hopefully it'll just be good music, you know?
Yeah, can't wait. Andy, it was really great to be able to have you on the show. Hopefully next time we'll meet. I don't know if you ever come to Paris or if there is such thing as another Winterdam in the not so distant future, or maybe at the Surf Factories. Introduce me to John. It was maybe 2 years ago at a Winterdam. I just did a quick selfie with John and I said, okay, John, I would love to come to the factory to do a factory tour with you. So I'm going to ask you to introduce me again to John so we can do this. Okay.
Yeah, no problem, dude. No problem.
What's the website where people can reach you and see where you are playing and what are the next project or the next place you are going to play?
Yeah, man, that's andywoodmusic.com. On most social medias, okay. I am Andy Wood Music. And if anyone is interested in the Woodshed Guitar Experience, that will be the third weekend in August. We have Robin Ford, Brent Mason, Andy Timmons, Greg Koch, Mark Letary, and we have Adam Nitti on bass and Jim Riley on drums, Travis Toy playing steel guitar, slide guitar. And it's a three-day event. It's on a camp. It's on a lakefront in Tennessee, and we just have a good time. Lots of learning, lots of jams, lots of hangs with the artists and that kind of thing. So if you're interested in that, that's woodshedguitarexperience.com. Registration's open and attendance is very limited. We're not doing a free for all. It's basically 100 people, and those that sign up get access to the exclusivity. I mean, we want it to be special. We want that like really special experience that you can't get anywhere else, you know?
And is that an opportunity also for you to learn some new tricks from those incredible guitar players?
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Absolutely. Like we're all fact, just, right? We're all like on the yeah. side of the stage, like a bunch of dorks watching whoever else. You know, it's like last year Joe Bonamassa played it. We're like, he's on stage. We're all like, man, what year is that? Oh man, hey, that's great. And like Andy Timmons starts playing. Everybody's like, oh man, it's phrasing. Brent's playing. And it's like, yeah, it's like nerd overload. I mean, it's a lot of guitar horsepower. And so of course, any of us are eager to still what kind of musical morsels might be lying around, you know.
All right, again, Andy, thank you very much for the time, and congratulations for the 2019 album Junktown. Is still a great album, so go listen to it, and hopefully I can't wait to listen to the next one. Thank you very much for the time, Andy.
Thank you, brother.
For the price of a magazine, subscribe to The Guitar Channel to access the full videos.